In 2010, the U.S. Secretary of Defense at the time, Robert Gates, told an audience at Duke University that he was concerned about a disconnect between the country as a whole and the few who fight its wars.
Even after 9/11, in the absence of a draft, for a growing number of Americans, service in the military, no matter how laudable, has become something for other people to do.
That civilian-military gap is also a concern to our next guest. She calls it the distance between those in and out of uniform, and she says it can lead to bad policies and incoherent strategies. Rosa Brooks is a law professor at Georgetown University. She's also been an advisor in the Pentagon and the State Department. Rosa, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Sasha.
Rosa, you write that one of the biggest misunderstandings about the civilian-military gap, which you actually describe as a gulf rather than a gap, is that it's cultural. You know, as you put it, it's basically the national security version of the red state, blue state divide. Would you explain more what you mean by that?
I think that people tend to think of the problem as a cultural problem. They tend to think of it as, oh, the military is more conservative, it's more southern, it's more this, it's more that. And those things are true, but not necessarily what we should be most worried about. It's a whole different set of issues that have much more to do with how people are trained to think about problems, how they're trained to think about their roles, how they're trained to think about what constitutes strategy versus what constitutes tactics, and so forth.
In terms of how that plays out in real life, the headline of one of your recent columns was, "Generals are from Mars, their bosses are from Venus." Now, I'm assuming that you witnessed some of those disconnects when you were in the Pentagon during the debate over a troop surge in Afghanistan. So what are some examples of that clash between the generals and their bosses playing out?
What struck me was very much how much of the degree to which people were just talking past each other. When President Obama came into office, he commissioned a Afghanistan-Pakistan strategy review, and they came back and they said, we need a more thoroughgoing counterinsurgency-oriented strategy to degrade, disrupt, and destroy al-Qaeda and prevent it from regaining a foothold in the region. Shortly after that, President Obama replaced the commanding general in Afghanistan with General Stanley McChrystal and told McChrystal to go out and do a 60-day assessment, how we were doing with regard to achieving those strategic goals that his review had laid out and what it would take to achieve them. So McChrystal goes out, and he's a military guy. He's got a mission. He's been told, how are we doing towards achieving those goals of what will it take to achieve them? And he comes back, and he essentially says, we're not doing very well, and I think that in order to make this possible, we're going to need, you know, probably 70 or 80,000 troops. And the White House says, are you kidding? Come back and give us a better answer, because that's just not politically feasible. Of course, McChrystal essentially goes back and says, that's the question you asked me. That's the answer to the question you asked me, in my opinion. I can't give you a different answer unless you give me a different question, which to the White House seemed like Pentagon intransigence. Like, what is wrong with these people? Why do they refuse to come back and give us a different answer? And to many in the military seemed like a problem of White House cluelessness, saying, you know, some of these things are just objective. If that's what you want to do, here's what it's going to take, in the opinion of your senior military officer. Eventually, there was a compromise. I don't think it was a very good compromise, and I think it's a compromise that has neither been good for Afghanistan nor great for civil-military relations. It was a sort of a split-the-baby compromise in which McChrystal did not get the 70 or so thousand troops he wanted. The White House did not get the zero they wanted. They compromised on 30,000 U.S. troops plus another almost 10,000 NATO troops with something resembling more of a timeline, which wasn't, in the end, what anybody wanted or probably what made sense.
And you think what happened there was simply a clash of worldviews, essentially?
In many ways. I mean, we hold deeply in this country, and quite rightly, to the idea of civilian control of the military. If you apply that in a very rigid way, how do you figure out strategy? How do you figure out what your goals should be if you don't understand the tactics and the operational stuff? And how do you come up with good operational or tactical responses if you aren't part of the strategy discussion?
Rosa, you've also written about an example involving someone who wanted a drone dispatched. Could you quickly give us a summary of that and how you see the clash playing out here?
Back a couple years ago, there were riots in Kyrgyzstan, and I got a phone call one day as I was sitting in my Pentagon office from an official at the National Security Council staff who said, I need you to get on the telephone to CENTCOM, Central Command, and have them get a drone over there. And I said, well, I can't do that. The chain of command doesn't go from a mid-level guy at the National Security Staff to an advisor to the Undersecretary of Defense to whoever is in charge of deploying drones in Central Command. It just doesn't work that way. And he got very frustrated. And he said, what is the problem? The president cares about this. The president wants to make sure that there's no outbreak of mass atrocities. I am calling you from the White House. Why can't we make this happen? Whatever happened to civilian control of the military? To which I said, unfortunately, you are the wrong civilian.
And what did you mean by that? I read that and I wondered exactly what you meant.
The chain of command goes from the president to the Secretary of Defense. Imagine the potential for world chaos, right? If mid-level White House staffers could wander around
and dispatch a drone
in Afghanistan,
right,
and just say to some major, "Well, major, I want you to do." It can't work that way.
So, Rosa, how do we fix this? I mean, when one side fundamentally doesn't understand the other side or the other side's policies, and then as a result, everyone thinks the other side is being recalcitrant or is just clueless.
Mm-hmm.
How do we fix the problem?
I think that there are two relatively easy fixes. One is to do something that on the military side that the military is already trying to do, but do it even more, which is make sure that officers, as they move up in the ranks, focusing on understanding, in a sense, how civilians think, how the decision-making processes work, looking at case studies of misunderstandings. And to some extent, the military is already trying to do that. And I think that that's something that can be accelerated.
Do we also need the flip side, meaning more civilian officers
side,
who
right.
served in the military?
Well, it's not so much military service necessarily. I think it's more just greater familiarity with an understanding of how the military planning process works. And there's not as much money on the civilian side. There's no real equivalent for civilians. A military officer can spend 2 years on a fellowship at the Council on Foreign Relations, or can be detailed over to serve on the White House staff. There's not really much equivalent for a civilian at the State Department or the White House to go spend a year working in the military chain of command, again, for some good reasons. This is not an impossible problem to solve. It's just if you don't really realize it exists, then it never occurs to you to try. You have to acknowledge it, and then you have to be willing to make a commitment to put some resources into fixing it. But I don't think it's impossible by any means.
So the gap can be narrowed.
Absolutely.
Rosa, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Sasha.
Rosa Brooks is a law professor at Georgetown University. She served as a counselor to the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2009 to 2011 and was also a senior advisor at the U.S. State Department. We'll link you to her recent column for Foreign Policy at hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.